जननीं शारदां देवीं रामकृष्णं जगद्गुरुं पादपद्मे तयोः श्रित्वा प्रणमामि मुहुर्मुहुः. We take refuge at the feet of Holy Mother Sri Sharada Devi and Great Master Sri Ramakrishna. Our salutations to them over and over again. Namah Shri Yati Rajaya Vivekananda Suraye Satchit Sukha Swarupaya Swamine Tapaharine. Salutations to the sage Swami Vivekananda, the king among renouncers, the embodiment of existence, knowledge, bliss absolute, and one who removes all our miseries. Om, peace, peace, peace. Om asatoma sadgamaya, tamasoma jyotirgamaya, mrityorma mrutangamaya. Om shanti, shanti, shanti. Lead us from the unreal to the real. Lead us from darkness to light. Lead us from death to immortality. Om, peace, peace. Peace be unto us. Peace be unto all. Friends, we continue with our study of Sadhana Panchakam. 5 verses on spiritual practices. We see the 4th practice. Apachitihi kamye matistyajyatam. That means renounce destructive thoughts of desire. That means let not the mind pursue what it wants, but you engage the mind constructively. Desire, that's what naturally arises in the mind. Desire does not come from outside. Desire come from our impressions. Desires come from our impressions, called the samskaras. And we have gained these impressions from our own thoughts, our own actions, over so many years, over so many lifetimes. Every thought, every action that we do consciously in the waking state leaves an impression. And we have good impressions, bad impressions, corresponding to good thoughts, good deeds, bad thoughts, bad deeds. And Swami Vivekananda teaches that every one of us is what we are, the sum total of these impressions. You give plus sign to the good impressions, minus sign to the bad impressions, take an algebraic sum. If the sum is positive, you have good character. If the sum is negative, you have bad character. So character is defined as the sum total of our impressions. And this sum total determines what we are at any given moment. What we are now, how we different people face identical situations in different ways is determined by our different sum totals. What we are, how we face problems, how we, if we are completely swept off our feet by problems, or we are able to understand the problems, face them squarely, and calmly go about doing what needs to be done, or we are somewhere intermediate between these two positions. All this is determined by the sum total of our impressions. And this sum total is not decided by God, but this sum total has been brought on us by ourselves, by our own thoughts, our own deeds, what we did in the past. So what we did in the past, the sum total of that, those impressions, determines what I am now. One important point that comes out of this discussion on samskaras is that this law of karma, this law of samskaras, should not make us fatalistic. Oh, whatever has to happen will happen. What have I to do? That'll amount to a wrong understanding of this theory. If my past is responsible for my present will be responsible for my future. I have that little element of freedom in me with which I can think and work in the right direction. I have the choice to increase the stock of my good impressions by thinking good, by doing good. And when the stock of good impressions goes up, the good side of my character gets strengthened. And if I don't do anything, the mind keeps on gathering negative impressions, only going to strengthen the bad side of my character. Bad impressions get augmented, and they become more powerful. And that explains why some people end up doing something bad in spite of themselves. They know what they're doing is bad, but still they continue to do it for the simple reason, because of the power of their bad impressions. And these impressions have desires embedded in them. It's good to dwell a little deeper on this aspect of desire being embedded in our impressions. When we do something, there is an impression formed in the mind, not in the brain, but in the mind. If it is formed in the brain, with death, all of us will be with a clean slate and we'll become knowers of Brahman, which doesn't happen. The body dies. So howsoever materialists would like to have us believe that brain is fundamental, matter is fundamental, and thoughts are secretion of the brain, consciousness is a finer secretion of the brain, we hold on to Vedantic teachings. That is, the spirit is supreme, over the spirit is the mind, outside of the mind is the body. So these impressions are registered in the mind. And these impressions have some properties. Let's say one impression. The impression has a knowledge component to it. Let's take the simple act of eating cheesecake. If I have not eaten cheesecake before, and suppose I ask someone who is familiar with this, how does cheesecake taste? That person will say it tastes sweet. How does the sweetness of cheesecake differ from that of rasagulla? I am familiar with rasagulla. You don't have an answer to this. You cannot say it tastes this way differently. Its sweetness is different from that of rasagulla in the following way. You don't have an answer. You will say you need to eat cheesecake to find out how cheesecake's sweetness differs from that of rasagulla or any other sweet that I am familiar with. So when I eat a cheesecake for the first time, an impression is formed. And that impression has this knowledge component to it. How does cheesecake taste? I won't have this knowledge component if I have not eaten cheesecake at all. So that is the first component. The second component, in the same impression, these are the properties of a single impression embedded in the mind. The first is knowledge. Second is the tendency to repeat that action. The third is memory of that action. The fourth is fruit of that action, called karma phala. This fruit of this action can come any time in future. But what we sow, so we reap. So the tendency to repeat that action is embedded in that samskara. And the memory of that action is also embedded in that samskara. So the first time you eat cheesecake, so I have this impression. I have a tendency to repeat this. So when I see someone eating cheesecake, or when I see cheesecake, my mouth starts watering. If I like that first helping of cheesecake, my mouth starts watering. I would like to eat cheesecake, and I go and help myself. So the second time I eat, the third time, fourth time, may not be in a single day, on different occasions. So every time I repeat this action, the existing impression gets deepened. You can roughly imagine, in the gross plane, suppose you have a hard surface and you have a sharp tool which is harder than the surface, and you draw a line on the surface. We are hardly able to draw a line. The line is imperceptibly light. Let's assume that we have a ruler, and with the help of that we draw a line. You hardly are able to see the line. Do it a second time, a third time, 50 times, the line becomes, you're able to cut a groove subsequently, after so many times. This is in the gross plane. This is only a very kind of a very rough example. Something similar happens in the subtle plane. The first time we eat cheesecake, an impression is made. Second time you eat, it gets slightly deepened. We repeat it sufficient number of times, it gets really deep. Deepening the tendency to repeat. The tendency to repeat is called desire. So desires arise from these impressions. Can we do something? And karma phala, that is not the topic of our discussion right now. That means the karma phala, the fruit of our action, can come sometime in future. That is called adrishta. Adrishta, drishta means what is seen. Adrishta means what is not seen. That means something sometime in the future. There is a verse, important verse in the Mahabharata, which when translated runs like this: as a calf among 1,000 cows finds out the mother kind, so deeds performed, good or bad, come and say, I am thine. So that is, every deed we perform leaves an impression, and we have to enjoy the karma phala. Enjoy in Sanskrit is bhoga, which refers to both pleasurable enjoyment and painful experience. Mm-hmm. Bhoga. Amake bhukti avachche. It doesn't mean only pleasurable.
No.
But that bhoga in Sanskrit is a special word. Mm-hmm. It doesn't indicate only enjoyment, but even miserable experience is covered under bhoga. So we have these in desire is embedded in our samskaras. And we also saw the third component was memory. Memory of eating this cheesecake. Now in most people, this memory and the tendency to repeat are inextricably connected. They're one. So a desire arises in my mind, and I said with sufficient repetition it becomes deep, and I don't need to see cheesecake anymore. I don't need to see anyone eating cheesecake anymore. I just think of cheesecake, my mouth starts watering. That means the impression has become sufficiently deep now. And I go and have a helping of cheesecake. So that this is an important point we try to understand. The tendency to repeat an action, that means the desire for that enjoyment, becomes strong as we repeat that action. Desires cannot be eliminated by fulfilling them. We have a story behind that, which also we see. Now is the time to fulfill our desires. We'll think about all this in the evening of our life, all this Gita, Vedanta, in the evening of our life. If our children are inclined toward going to a center or going to the ashram, or if they show any inclination to study of the Bhagavad Gita or Sri Ramakrishna, as parents we get alarmed. Most parents get alarmed. It's all okay as long as it doesn't happen to my own children. That's the idea. So such and such a person is going to the ashram, has become a swami, oh, it's good. Even then, that becomes a subject of gossip for some days. But if it happens in my own place, I become completely crestfallen. So, how did I begin this? Samskara is right. So this...
Bhoga.
Right.
You enjoy the desire.
Okay, so this we have this, the desire for enjoyment becomes stronger as we repeat that action. Huh. Oh yeah, this is the time for enjoyment, and then don't think about higher things.
Right.
But it doesn't work that way. There is time enough for all this, and in the evening of your life, after you retire from your worldly responsibilities, then again there is time enough to think about God and all that. But people who give this advice, you can ask them. You are apparently free of your responsibilities. Is your mind spontaneously turning toward God? That's a very uncomfortable question for them. So the mind doesn't automatically turn to God on the day of our retirement. That's a very simple fact to understand. If we are done with our life, we got our children married, and then we try to live their life on their behalf. What we have failed to achieve in our life, we try to achieve through our daughter, through our son, which they don't like anyway. That's a very unfortunate thing. The world is, Swami Vivekananda says, the world is too much with us. Let's, for a change, give up attending to this world for some time and start taking care of ourselves. Swami Vivekananda, who spoke about doing good to the world, he spoke on these lines also. We have lived our life. Let the children live their life. If they seek our advice, let's give the advice by all means. Otherwise, the time has come for us to think about God. Are we thinking about God or about our grandchildren or about our children? So this is an important point for people to reflect on. So desires don't get eliminated by fulfilling them. There is an important story. to illustrate this fact that desires cannot be quenched by enjoyment. There was a king by name Yayati. You find him in the Mahabharata, you find him in the Bhagavata also. He was a noble king and he had four sons. And this king, while offering hospitality to a holy man called Durvasa. Durvasa was known for his anger.
Yeah.
You want to slightly increase the volume?
Yeah.
So he was known for his anger. So there was some kind of transgression on the part of the king while offering hospitality. So this holy man immediately cursed the king. You will become old immediately. But this king was shocked. He fell at the feet of the sage and then said what amends he could make so that this curse would not prove true. So the Durvasa said that whatever had escaped his mouth will have to prove true. But he had this option. The king had this option. He could exchange. If some youth was prepared to exchange his youth for the king's old age, the king can become young once again. But the young man will become old. So where will this king go? So he went to his oldest son, told him of this predicament, and asked him if he could exchange his youth for his old age. The son loved his father, all right, but he had his own life before him. He cannot afford to become old because he has a desire for enjoyment in his own mind. So he politely declined. The same answer the king got from his second and third sons. And the fourth son is said to be especially dear to the father. So when the father made this request, he said yes, and he exchanged his youth for the king's old age. Now the focus is on the king. The king continued to remain young, and according to the Puranic hyperbole, he ruled for thousands of years. That means for a long, long time. See, that's a Puranic exaggeration. What is meant is, he ruled for a long time, because Shatayurvai Purushaha, that means a man lives for a maximum of 100 years. So thousands of years is only to drive home the point that he lived life as a king and all those royal pleasures which was not possible for any normal human being, all those pleasures were the king's, and he lived a life of enjoyment. He also had his own responsibility as a king, and after so many years of such enjoyment, the king said something. You have an important verse put into the mouth of this king. The king said, Najatu kamaha kamana upabhogena shamyati. Desires can never be quenched by fulfilling them. Havisha krishna vartmeva bhuyayeva abhivardate. Havisha, havis means ghee. It only flames up all the more, just as fire flames up all the more when you pour ghee into it. So we keep on fulfilling desires. It keeps on deepening the impression that we receive from that fulfillment. So it only flames up all the more. Desires don't die down on the day of retirement. And the mind doesn't spontaneously turn toward God. So desire. Desire is something important. We understand. We need to understand. We all understand that desire comes from within us. Though there is some stimulus possible from outside. But that stimulus kindles my impression and the desire comes up. And without batting an eyelid, I go about fulfilling it. But what does a spiritual seeker do? A spiritual seeker gradually learns to distance himself from this tendency to repeat. If there is a memory of that action, we can leave it alone. The desire to repeat this action also, as it arises in the mind, as we grow in willpower, grow in strength, grow in detachment, we are able to witness this desire to repeat, and we learn to safely leave it alone. Mm-hmm. That leaving it alone is important. We learn it by repeated practice. That means we learn to detach ourselves from our thoughts. Every desire arising in the mind does not need fulfillment. Because if we keep on fulfilling desires, we have seen, we won't be able to get rid of desires by fulfilling them. And desires, where do desires lead us? We human beings supposed to be special in God's creation. This human birth is a rare birth. So because of certain important things, the most important is, it is only in a human body that we can think of God, we can realize God. But the effect of desire, how desire gradually leads towards spiritual ruin, is explained beautifully in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. When Sri Krishna explains to Arjuna the signs of a man of steady wisdom, sthita prajna lakshana, there he says, when you think about sense objects, you gradually develop attachment to them. Attachment to sense objects results in desire to possess them. Desire results in anger at everything that stands in the fulfillment of this desire, stands in the way of fulfillment. Desire and anger, they're always twin companions. Wherever there is desire, there'll be anger. Any obstacle to the fulfillment of desire, I get angry at them. Desire leads to anger. Anger leads to delusion, self-delusion. We become deluded. Delusion means a perverted understanding of things, mistaking the right for wrong. Delusion is a sign of tamas, moha. Moha is a sign of tamas, the lowermost quality. Dullness, excessive sleep, laziness, a tendency to postpone things. That is tamas. So delusion is a perverted understanding of things, mistaking the right for wrong, mistaking the pleasant for the beneficial. So this leads to loss of memory. Delusion leads to loss of memory. Loss of memory of what? Loss of memory of the fact that we are responsible individuals in society with our own duties to perform. Loss of memory of the values we imbibe from our teachers, from our parents. Loss of memory fundamentally of the fact that we are the spirit. We are not the body, we are not the mind. But we are supposed to be one up with respect to our mind and body. So we lose memory of everything that is useful to us. And we lose memory of the spiritual goal to be striven for. So loss of memory leads to loss of discrimination. Buddhi nasha. Smriti bramsha. Buddhi nasha. Buddhi nasha means we lose the faculty of discrimination. Buddhi, we saw yesterday, it's an important Sanskrit word. We need to understand the different shades of meaning of this buddhi in its original, instead of being contented with that inadequate translation, intellect. Buddhi means the seat of discrimination. When we discriminate between what is right and what is wrong, what is beneficial to the attainment of the spiritual goal, and what will lead me to bondage, or what will keep me in a state of bondage. This is discrimination. This is possible only when we have an ideal, but we have forgotten the ideal. Loss of memory leads to loss of discrimination. When I don't have a memory about the goal to be striven for, I am unable to discriminate any further, and loss of discrimination leads to spiritual death. Buddhi nashat pranashyati. Spiritual death, that means our own spiritual nature becomes alien to us. We just remain a bundle of bones and flesh, a body-mind complex, and we are dictated by our desire, our likes and dislikes. So that is what desire leads us to. Desire leads us to our spiritual ruin. There is a beautiful verse in the Hitopadesha. Hita means beneficial. Upadesha means teaching. Teachings that are beneficial to us. It's a brief word. So there it says, there are four factors common to human beings and animals. The first is eating. Next is sleeping. Third is fear. Both animals have fear. Human beings also have fear. Fourth is the tendency to procreate, sexual urge. This is also common to animals and human beings. Eating, sleeping, fear, sexual urge. These are common to human beings and animals. So what differentiates a human being from animals? The answer is, in that verse of Hitopadesha, it is dharma which differentiates human beings from animals. And what does dharma mean? Dharma again is a very interesting word. having more than one meaning in English. Dharma means religion, Hindu dharma means its religion. Dharma means righteousness. Dharma means morality. Dharma could mean our own real nature. Real nature in the sense our mindset. Dharma could be, yes, my qualities, manava dharma, what the nature of a human being. But what concerns us here is the meaning, righteousness, morality. So by implication, dharma means the power to discriminate. And when we are righteous, when we try to live a moral life, we always discriminate between what is moral, what is immoral, and hold on to morality and give up what is immoral. It is that which distinguishes human beings from animals. So a human being who does not exercise this power of discrimination, there is nothing to differentiate him or her from animals, save the power of speech. We continue to be, man is a social animal by definition. So we are social animals if we don't exercise the power of discrimination. So human beings can have a goal before them, can exercise the power of discriminate between what is right and what is wrong, and with their will hold on to what is right and give up what is wrong. Mere discrimination of right and wrong, discrimination between the right and the wrong, alone is not enough. We'll know what is right, we'll know what is wrong, but do we have the strength to take to the right thing, and do we have the strength to give up what is wrong? Duryodhana could not do it. Duryodhana said, I know what is right, I'm not able to practice it. I know what is wrong, I'm not able to give it up. So Duryodhana did not lack discrimination, but he lacked detachment. Detachment from what is bad. So when we discriminate and hold on to what is good and give up what is bad, then that lends meaning to human life. If that doesn't happen, our life keeps drifting. And what we do, what we think, is determined by our impressions. So desire. Desire is our greatest enemy, teaches Sri Krishna in the third chapter of the Gita. It robs us of our wisdom and realization. And therefore, Sri Krishna says, toward the end of the third chapter, he gives the very first fundamental teaching to Arjuna. Tasma tum indriyani adau niyamya bharatarshava paapmanam prajahihenam jnana vijnana nashanam. Therefore, at the outset, discipline your senses. That is the first teaching Sri Krishna gives Arjuna. If we give a free rein to the senses and the mind, they will only lead us astray. But if we learn to rein them in, then we lend meaning to our human life and we are doing real good to ourselves. So disciplining the senses, disciplining the mind. And Sri Krishna gives one more teaching, important teaching in the Gita. Buddhau sharanam anvichcha, take refuge in the buddhi. Take refuge in the buddhi means what? Abide as an entity different from the mind. By default we are one with the mind. But Sri Krishna says take refuge in the buddhi. That means always assert your independence from the mind. Don't follow what the mind says. Don't follow the desires arising in the mind. But assert your independence. Do and think in a way that is beneficial to you. So that's an important teaching. Buddhau sharanam anvichcha. Kripana falahetavaha. It means people who seek just immediate ends are petty or narrow-minded. You take refuge in buddhi. That is the seat of discrimination, that is the seat of equanimity, that is the seat of even-mindedness. And this is an important point in Karma Yoga. In Karma Yoga, when we do work, we don't think about the future. We don't dwell on the past, but we try to be in the present. We try not to go with the mind. The mind has its own agenda, and in a moment's notice, it can travel thousands of miles. It can go to San Francisco from here, or maybe to India. And it can traverse decades in the past. I'll in a moment relive my childhood experience. I go back to 40 years, 50 years, and it's not just a fleeting thought which I am observing as a witness, but I am one with them. So the mind can think about something that happened 40 years back, take me there, and thousands of miles away, but I am here. I am here with a book in hand, and I am here with a task in hand, but my mind has gone somewhere. That would be okay, provided I don't go with the mind. But most of the time, why most of the time? All the time, the mind that goes to India 40 years back takes me along with it, only my body remaining here, eyes wide open, book also wide open, eyes wide open, but I have gone somewhere else along with the mind. This happens to every one of us. So this clearly shows we are different from this body. We are different from the mind. We are different from the mind as we understand it later, but we are helplessly taken for a ride by the mind, unable to pursue our own agenda. The mind makes us forcibly pursue its agenda. So, we are on the subject of desire. Sri Krishna says, Buddhau Sharanam Anvichcha, take refuge in the Buddhi. That means, always assert your independence as an entity different from the mind, different from the body. The next practice, fifth practice, Papaugaha Paridhuyatam, get rid of bad impressions. This is related to the previous teaching. Get rid of bad impressions. We have dwelt sufficiently on this subject. Samskaras we get by our good actions, by our bad actions, by our good thoughts, by our bad thoughts. Get rid of bad impressions. How do we do it? We get rid of bad impressions. We become free from the hold of bad impressions by cultivating more of good impressions. That way, the good side of our character gets strengthened. We cannot do bad even if we want to. That is being established in moral life, that is strengthening the good side of our character. But that's not the goal for spiritual seekers. For spiritual seekers, moral life is not the goal. But moral life, without moral life, spiritual life is not possible. But for most people, being established in moral life itself is a sufficiently high ideal. Why should we worry about spiritual life? Why should we worry about God? I believe in living a moral life. Go ahead. That's not very easy. But mere moral life is not the goal for spiritual seekers. Because mere moral life does not give us the strength to remain unfazed by inevitable problems in the world. I may be good, but how far I am able to face situations in life, face misery in life? Misery could just displace us completely. We are just moral. But when we are spiritual, we try to transcend both good and evil. We try to take a stand beyond good and evil. So evil loses its sting on us. As we saw yesterday, we live in this world of good and evil will always alternate. But we remain insulated from both, and we try to seek God who transcends both within. So that's an important point we understand from this. We can get rid of bad impressions by cultivating more and more of good impressions, and we establish the good side of our character, but that alone is not the goal of life. We need to transcend both good and evil. If we are under the sway of bad impressions, we are bad in spite of ourselves, that we saw. If we are under the sway of good impressions, we are good in spite of ourselves. We can be so good that we'll be unable to say no when the situation demands that. Oh, what will that person think if I say no? You have to say no. You're not going to be harsh. You're not going to be disrespectful. If you have to say no, have the strength to say no for anything. If you need to say no. So people can be so good, they won't be able to say no when there is a need for saying no. But they'll be burning within. So this is being under the sway of good impressions in spite of ourselves. Swami Vivekananda says, if bad impressions could be compared to an iron chain, good impressions can be compared to a golden chain. They are different as iron and gold, but they are the same in their binding power as a chain. So good impressions also bind us. So Swami Vivekananda says, there is a state superior to being good, and that is the desire for freedom. Freedom from both good and bad. So a spiritual seeker seeks freedom. And this freedom is different from the freedom that most people are familiar with in the world. We are citizens of a free country, and we are free to pursue what we want. We are free to pursue our desire. Of course, we have our rights, we have our duties. We have to ensure that our pursuit of desire does not come in the way of others' pursuit of desire. We don't tread others on our way to the fulfillment of our desire. But this freedom, freedom to pursue desire, is freedom of the mind and the senses to pursue objects of desire. That is the freedom that people in general are aware of. But spiritual seekers begin to become aware of a different kind of freedom. The first was freedom for the mind and the senses. Spiritual seekers want freedom from the mind and the senses. Freedom from the mind. The mind takes me somewhere. I don't want to go with the mind. I want to be strong and remain rooted in what I am. I want that freedom as a spiritual seeker. I want freedom in the spirit. Freedom from the mind and the senses. Not freedom for the mind and the senses, which is the default kind of freedom. So get rid of bad impressions. That's the teaching. Bad impressions we can get rid of when we consciously engage in good actions, when we consciously think noble thoughts. If we leave the mind to think noble thoughts, it will, after thousands of useless trash thoughts. So instead of leaving the mind to think good thoughts, I could think of my spiritual ideal today. Yes, that is possible. The mind was probably especially gracious, but most of the time it gravitates towards trash, towards objects of enjoyment. So we don't leave it to the mind. That will be too costly a thing to do for spiritual seekers. We don't let the mind think noble thoughts. We consciously think noble thoughts. Otherwise, the mind will think of only thoughts that it is used to think. The mind's line of least resistance is to be united with a sense organ, which gets united with a sense object. That's its default chain, line of least resistance. If it is to be otherwise, we need to consciously think good thoughts. Swami Vivekananda says, just as bad thoughts and bad deeds are ready to pounce on us like tigers, there is also the inspiring hope that good thoughts and good deeds are ready with the power of 100,000 angels to defend us always and forever. So good thoughts and good deeds, we consciously engage in these to be free from the hold of the mind. The next teaching, sixth practice, is Bhavasukhe Doshaha Anusandhiyata. Reflect on the defects of worldly enjoyment. Reflect. Because we need to be reflective, to be responsible for our own life. We see others. If we learn from others, well and good, but it hardly happens. We need to learn from our own experience, and we need to be reflective. So reflect on the defects of worldly enjoyment. Worldly enjoyment doesn't need much of an elaboration, but we can see what the Bhagavad Gita says about it. In the 18th chapter, we have three kinds of so many things: sattvika, rajasika, and tamasika. We have a few in the 17th chapter also, but we have in the 18th chapter more. Three kinds of work, three kinds of worker, three kinds of buddhi, three kinds of dhriti, three kinds of knowledge, three kinds of happiness. All this so clearly spelled out. If only we read it with an open mind and we try to assimilate those teachings, if we are reflective, instead of thinking how admirably this applies to her or him, how admirably it applies to me, that'll make a sea change, that'll help me grow. But our mind is so outward directed, when we see some description, just like her, just like him. Instead of that, when I grow in introspection, I try to work on my own character. So there you have three kinds of happiness: sattvika happiness, rajasic happiness, tamasic happiness. We'll focus on rajasic happiness. Rajasic happiness is like nectar in the beginning, but like poison in the end. It arises from the contact of sense organs with their sense objects. That's the definition. Yatta dagre That is yatta dagre vishamiva. That is sattvika happiness. But we want rajasika happiness. Vishayendriya sanyoga yatta dagre amrutopamam tatsukam sat rajasam proktam. No, I am getting mixed up. Rajasic happiness is that which arises from the contact of sense organs with their sense objects. It's like nectar in the beginning, but like poison in the end. It's like poison in the end. We're able to appreciate in the light of the verses we studied in the second chapter of the Gita, how desire leads to gradual spiritual ruin. But it's like nectar in the beginning because of that momentary happiness. Contact of the sense organs with their sense objects. But this gradually leads to spiritual ruin. Nachiketas, that little boy in the Kathopanishad, he was offered boons by Yama. This boy went to Yama's abode. He saw his father performing sacrifice, yajna. And the father was a little miserly. When the time came to offer dakshina, gifts to Brahmins, which was part of this yajna, the father gave away useless cows, cows which cannot yield calves anymore. And the cows had them in fit to go to slaughterhouses, that kind of cows. So you're able to dispose of them, and also you can earn some spiritual merit by way of gift. That is the calculation in his father's mind. But this boy was known for Shraddha Avivesha in Nachiketa's mind. So he was not happy. He was not happy that the father is not going to get the fruit of the sacrifice by this useless gifts. So the boy asked the father, "To whom are you going to give me?" So the father dismissed this. He pretended not having heard this boy. The second time, the boy asked the question. The father tried to control his anger. The third time the boy asked this question, "You I give to death," the father pronounced out of his anger. The boy, endowed with Shraddha, thought that if he didn't go to the abode of Yama, he will prove his father's words false, which again will nullify the sacrifice that the father performed. So he immediately started out for the abode of Yama, death. And there he waited for 3 days and 3 nights. Yama had gone on some errand somewhere. And this boy refused to accept hospitality from anyone in Yama's house. He waited for 3 nights and 3 days and 3 nights without any food and any drink. And Yama comes. Yama is supposed to be Dharma, embodiment of Dharma. So when he comes back and sees this Brahmin boy waiting at his doors without hospitality for 3 days, he understood how spiritually detrimental this state of affairs would be for him. How, when a guest is at your doors without hospitality, that robs you of your spiritual merit. Yama was aware of it. So he wanted to make amends. So he said, "You asked me a boon for each night you spent here at the gates." He didn't go inside the house. So Yama said, I'll grant you 3 boons for the 3 days and nights you spent here at my place." So the first boon, Nachiketas asked, was, "When I go back home, let my people not mistake me for a ghost. Let them accept me with open arms." So some people say Nachiketas made sure with his one boon that he was going back, and his people won't mistake him for a ghost. Okay, that's one. Some people may say it's kind of calculative on the part of Nachiketas, but no, he was a boy endowed with Shraddha. But he made sure of going back. And the second boon was, Nachiketas wanted to be taught about a fire sacrifice. And Yama taught him that, what are the different paraphernalia required for this sacrifice, how were the bricks to be arranged, the altar to be made, and how were offerings to be made. All these in details, Yama taught Nachiketas. And Nachiketas, the brilliant boy, student that he was, he grasped everything that the teacher taught. And the teacher was immensely happy with the student grasping everything he taught. He said, may I get more students like you?" The teacher is very happy when the students understand what the teacher teaches. So Yama was very happy. He was so happy that he named that Agni, named that sacrifice Nachiketa Agni. He named that sacrifice after Nachiketa himself. And then comes the third boon. Nachiketa said, some people say everything is over with death. Some people say man continues to live after death. I would like to know from you conclusively what is true. This is a very difficult question. Not that Yama didn't know the answer, but he didn't want to be bothered with this question. So he tried to dissuade this boy. He said, even the gods and goddesses are perplexed about this question. They don't have a clear answer to it. So ask for something else. The boy said, if the gods and goddesses are also perplexed about this question, all the more I would like to have answer to this question. For you are the one who can admirably answer this question. I want only this. Yama didn't yield immediately. He wanted to entice this boy, entice him with rare enjoyments. He said, have all this music, have all these dancing girls, have all these horses, and you will have all kinds of enjoyment when you go back home, and you will live for as long as you want on the earth, and all these rare pleasures will be yours. But don't persist with this question. But Nachiketas was one in whom Shraddha had entered. So he said, keep all these horses, all these girls, all these music to yourself. I want only answer to this question. So that was the boy. He said, all these enjoyments, what is pertaining to our discussion? Sarveindriyanam jarayanti teja. Nachiketas told Yama that all these enjoyments, rare enjoyments that you promised me, only sap the vigor of the senses. They only weaken the senses. So keep all these enjoyments to yourself. Give me answer only to that question. And then follows the teachings of the Kathopanishad on the nature of the Atman. And you have the famous chariot imagery there, Atmanam Rathinam Vidhi. So here, Shraddha, Nachiketas, Shraddha entered into Nachiketas. He didn't easily fall for worldly enjoyments. Worldly enjoyments, rajasic happiness, is like nectar in the beginning, but it's like poison at the end. So we need to struggle for sattvic happiness as spiritual seekers. And what is sattvic happiness? When we're going to discuss sattvic happiness, we can as well discuss what is tamasic happiness, which we don't want anyway. But if we have any hankering for it, we know it when we study this verse. Tamasic happiness, because these descriptions are for us to reflect on, and if we have any inclinations of them, we need to work on ourselves. Tamasic happiness, all these three kinds of happiness, how it is in the beginning, how it is in the end, that is one factor. Second, how does it arise? So we saw rajasic happiness is like nectar in the beginning, like poison at the end. And it arises from the contact of sense organs with their sense objects. Now, tamasic happiness, at the beginning and at the end, it leaves a person in delusion. And what does it arise from? It arises from excessive sleep, laziness, carelessness, pramada. Carelessness, this pramada, again, is an important word. Carelessness, absent-mindedness, apathy, daydreaming, wool gathering, all these meanings will fit this pramada. Dreaming with both the eyes open, that is what is pramada, right? That means we are in kind of a half asleep state. We give the mind a free rein. That means we are in the waking state and also in the dream state. Nothing can be more detrimental to a spiritual seeker. So apathy, that means not taking our own life seriously. Let's forget about spiritual life. There are people who don't take their own life seriously. They cannot study well, and if they have studied also, they won't be able to keep a job, and they'll be dependent on their parents as long as they're alive. Then they'll come to their senses probably when they're on the street. But when it comes to spiritual life too, we can never be too careful about our life. We need to take our life seriously. We need to do what is right and give up what is wrong. So, We have to struggle for sattvic happiness. Tamasic happiness leaves us in a state of delusion in the beginning and at the end. It arises from excessive sleep. Every one of us needs a certain hours of sleep. Those hours may not be the same for everyone. But we know when we overstep the limit. When we overstep the limit, we'll become so tired for sleeping, but so tired by sleeping for long that we'll once again go back to sleep. So that is tamas. So excessive sleep, laziness, tendency to postpone things. This is tamasic happiness. Sattvic happiness is what we have to strive for as spiritual seekers. What is sattvic happiness? The Gita says, sattvic happiness is possible only by steadfast, repeated practice. Abhyasat ramate yatra dukkantam chanigacchati. Sattvic happiness is possible by repeated practice, and it will lead us, it will put an end to all our misery. And how does it arise? Sattvic happiness is like poison in the beginning, but like nectar at the end. It arises from the buddhi abiding in the Atman. Atma buddhi prasadajam. Sattvic happiness is hardly different from the bliss arising from realization, because sattva is the penultimate step. One more step, we become knowers of the Atman. So when the buddhi is settled in the Atman, that means it is distanced from the mind, senses, body, everything outside. The buddhi is turned within and is its dwelling in the Atman. That is sattvic happiness. And this needs repeated practice. And it's like poison in the beginning, but like nectar in the end. Nectar in the end because it leads to immortality. Poison at the beginning because the mind doesn't want us to pursue sattvic happiness. We have seen that the mind's line of least resistance is outward directed. Pursue sense organs pursue sense objects. That's the line of least resistance. That's the default mode of the mind. To wean this mind from this pursuit of sense objects, to give it an inward turn, is easier said than done. But only human beings can do it. And in the beginning, it's like swallowing a bitter pill. It's like poison in the beginning. Giving an inward turn to the mind is as difficult as reversing the course of a river, says Sri Shankara in his commentary on one of the verses in the Kathopanishad. The Ganga originates from Gangotri in the Himalayas. Flows down, it comes, flows down the Himalayas, you find it in Rishikesh, Haridwar. Finally, it comes to, we see it in Calcutta, you see in Varanasi, then it comes to Calcutta. And finally, in West Bengal, it meets with the ocean in Ganga Sagar. If somewhere in this course, someone decides to reverse the course of Ganga and drive it back to Gangotri, it's an impossible task. Sri Shankara says, giving an inward turn to the mind, which is habitually outward directed, is like reversing a course of this river. But it is possible. It's possible only for human beings, because this is the greatest challenge for us human beings. So here, the teaching is, reflect on the defects of worldly enjoyment. So we try to give up rajasic happiness, and we try to strive for sattvic happiness. Now it's 12:50. Do we throw open for questions? All right. We can consider some more. If any of you has any questions in the middle, raise your hands. We can see. Yes.
You said deja. Deja can be many, like it should become good in study or get good wealth, all those things, if you don't get it, it develops anger and obstruction, all those memory loss, and all those things can happen. But the Alzheimer's patients in the old age who got the memory loss, do you think those things are also associated with them? I sometimes think like my mother, who was wanting one of her daughter will always stay with her, But she died at the age like 32. After that, she lost her mind or something like that.
That is because of degeneration of the brain cells. It's a physical disease, which also affects the mind. It's not that that loss of memory is completely, people stop recognizing their own sons, daughters. But this loss of memory is, we are still awake. We are still awake, we remember things. We remember what objects to pursue. We lose memory of higher things because of desire. We lose memory of the values we need to live for. That one is a physical condition, that's a disease. They may still have desires, all that in their minds, but their brain, as a very important instrument, loses its ability to function normally.
Because of the old age?
Yeah, because of it. It's like any other disease. Some people have cancer, some people have other diabetes, hypertension. So this is something to do with brain cells. They call dementia, and Alzheimer's is a special form of dementia. Yes, I don't know if they have found out any cure for it yet. People know, right? But I'd like to address one point here. Desire. We saw desire is our worst enemy, and desire leads to a spiritual ruin. But in our everyday life, we have desires.
Yes.
So how do we go about it? We all of us strive for freedom from desire. Sri Krishna says in the Gita, he gives an important teaching. Dharma viruddho bhuteshu kamosmi bharatarshava. I am in the form of desires, not opposed to dharma. That means, as long as our desires don't come in the way of others, as long as our desires are based on morality, we are on the right track. See, in Hinduism, you have four values to strive for, four purusharthas: dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. Dharma is morality. Artha is pursuit of wealth. Kama is fulfillment of desire. Moksha is freedom. Moksha is the last value. So pursuit of wealth and pursuit of desire, it's common in the world. But we need to keep the first value in mind when we pursue desire and pursue wealth. That means dharma. Our pursuit of wealth and our pursuit of desire should not be contradictory to dharma. We should not, our pursuit of desire and wealth should not come in the way of others' pursuits. We shouldn't step on the toes of others, and we shouldn't pursue our desires by hook or by crook. As long as we pursue our desires morally, we will one day aspire for freedom, moksha. And if we do it immorally, if we earn wealth by immoral means, that very earning by immoral means leaves a samskara in us. And when we want to be rid of samskaras, that proves to be a very strong obstacle. So, we need to ensure that we are grounded in morality. And as householders, it's our responsibility to earn money. Swami Vivekananda says, a householder who does not strive for earning money commits a sin. You find in the second chapter of second lecture on Karma Yoga, each is great in his own place, Swami Vivekananda says. That means we need to strive for wealth, because unless your basic needs are satisfied, the mind cannot think of anything higher. Religion is not for empty stomach, Sri Ramakrishna. So unless our basic needs are satisfied, we won't seek anything higher. So we need to seek wealth, but we need to seek it by rightful means. Sri Ramakrishna makes it very clear. Wealth can be earned by rightful means, it is perfectly all right. And whatever we have beyond our needs, it should be put to good use. So that's about desire. And this teaching was, reflect on the defects of worldly enjoyment. So instead of letting the mind seek rajasic happiness, let's struggle by repeated practice to seek sattvic happiness. Seventh teaching, Atmecha Vyavasiyatam. Resolutely cultivate awareness of the Atman. This is an important teaching. And Swami Vivekananda was never tired of giving this teaching. Think of the Atman, think of your higher nature. Someone asked Sri Ramana Maharshi. He was the one who popularized Vichara Marga. the path of self-inquiry. Someone asked him, why should we do Atma-vichara? Sri Ramana Maharshi said, if you don't do Atma-vichara, Loka-vichara will start. The mind wants to do only Loka-vichara. Loka-vichara means thoughts about the world. Atma-vichara is inquiry of the self. If you don't do self-inquiry, the mind will inquire about worldly objects, which is what it's happy with. So if you don't do Atma-vichara, Loka-vichara will start. That was the simple answer Sri Ramana Maharshi gave. So resolutely cultivate awareness of the Atman. We are men, women, based on the body. That's a very superficial, gross, kind of very cursory distinction. As long as we look upon ourselves as man, as woman, we send invites to misery. We can look upon ourselves as children of God. When we look upon ourselves as children of God who abides within, when we look upon ourselves as sparks of those of the divine fire, we gradually grow in detachment from our body. We begin to feel that we are not this body. The state of realization is far away. But we have a sense of freedom. We don't remain body bound. We try to exercise more of control over what we consume, what we eat. There is a teaching separately about eating, which Shankara gives in this important verse itself. So that's an important point. When we cultivate this awareness that we are the Atman, we don't look upon ourselves as white, black, tall, short, man, woman. And we also try to penetrate a little deeper when we see others. We don't interact with others. We don't. Their external doesn't just occupy our consciousness. And we don't judge people based on their appearance, based on their mindset. Because a person's color is like this, he has to be like this, she has to be like this. These are all very superficial kind of things. If I am body-bound, I am body-bound to others also. If I grow in detachment from my body, I get detached proportionately from others also. So the problem starts with me. So resolutely cultivate awareness of the Atman, we saw yesterday, amounts to cultivating a self-image. I am a luminous being. I am a spiritual being. I am not the body. I am not the mind. I am an entity different from the body, different from the mind. The more we cultivate this, the better will be our spiritual practice. And this awareness is perfectly compatible with our devotion. Let's not go back home with the idea that if we cultivate this, I am the awareness, I am the Atman awareness, where will my devotion go? Devotion will remain here, strengthened. It will be dusted off all the cobwebs and it will become purer and purer. Mm-hmm. According to Sri Ramanuja's philosophy, Vishishtadvaita, by the way, karma yoga leads to jnana.
Yeah.
And this jnana is different from the ultimate jnana. This jnana means realization that I am a spark of the divine fire. Realization in the sense, I know I am different from the body, different from the mind, but I am a spark. I have not still fully manifest my divinity. But I know that I am a detached personality by experience. Sri Ramakrishna says, when the mind ascends to the heart plane, to the heart level, the aspirant sees light and then says, ha, me, what is this? What is this? Gospel.
Yeah.
Right? Yes. So that is Sri Ramanuja's experience of Atmavalokana. That means he is able to be aware that he is the Atman, Jivatman, the spark of the divine fire. And this Jivatman, when he has reached this state, that means he is detached from the body, detached from the senses, detached from the mind. He has no use for objects in the world. So how does he abide? He starts seeking the fire within, the truth within. He is luminous, and he knows what a great luminous being God is. So this desire for this luminous being, the spark, to become one with the divine fire within, is what Sri Ramanuja calls devotion. So jnana leads to bhakti. So the more we are aware that our true nature is formless, the more we truly begin to love God. We begin to become aware more and more of what God is. And the more the knowledge of God, the stronger becomes our devotion. This is an important point. Because we may think, oh, we are in the world, we have our responsibilities, all this cultivating awareness of the Atman, all this is all okay, but doesn't work for me. It will work for all of us. It doesn't work for us because of certain of our preconceived understanding. The more we think that we are the spirit, the stronger we become, the less superstitions we have. And the stronger, the more refined becomes our devotion. Sri Ramakrishna says in the Gospel, there are certain teachings which we will easily skip, not willing strongly. It's not that we are wanting insincerity or whatever, but only when the right time comes, does the right teaching make a dent in our mind. Sri Ramakrishna says, unless you know someone, how can you love him? The more we get to know about someone, the more we tend to love him or her. So the more you tend to know about God, the more you tend to love God. So knowledge of God and love of God can coexist. And in the ultimate, in the apex, knowledge and devotion merge together, and supreme knowledge, parajnana, and supreme bhakti, parabhakti, are one and the same. So resolutely cultivate awareness of the Atman can be admirably applied to people in the world also. So we don't need to be afraid of these teachings, because these are not supposed to make us kindle fear in us, but they are supposed to kindle strength in us. So we cultivate this awareness that we are the Atman, we are the spirit. Swami Vivekananda gives a beautiful, he improvises on an important verse in the Avadhuta Gita. Kinnama rodishi sakhe, what makes you weep, my friend? Tvai sarva shaktihi, in you is all power. Amantrayasva bhagavan bhagadam swarupam, manifest the divine glory, the divine nature of yours. What makes you weak, my friend? In you is all power, manifest that inner power. When you manifest that, trilokyameta dakilam tava padamule, all this universe will be at your feet. Why? Atmaivahi prabhavate na jadah kadachit. Because it's only the spirit that prevails, that triumphs, not matter. This world will be at your feet. What does that mean? You manifest your inner nature, you manifest your divine glory, in you is all power. What makes you weep, my friend? In you is all power. Learn to manifest that power. And this universe will be at your feet. We are at the feet of the universe when we are enslaved by sense objects. But when we gain self-mastery over sense objects are at our feet. So the universe will be at your feet when you manifest your true nature. That's because it's only the spirit that prevails, not matter. Atmayavahi prabhavate na jada kadachit. Jada means inert. This entire matter, everything is matter. Our mind is matter, body is matter, senses are matter. The unfortunate situation is, we, the Atman, we, the spirit, are energizing the mind. We are animating this mind and the senses. We let the mind, inert mind, function by animating the mind with the consciousness that we are. And the mind takes us for a ride. That's a very unfortunate state to be in. We let the mind take us for a ride by getting attached to the mind, thereby energizing it. So when we detach ourselves from the mind has no fuel to function. We supply the mind with fuel, and the mind takes us, consciousness, for a ride. That's an unfortunate situation. How does this happen? Why should this happen? No answer. You find in one of Swami Ashokanandaji's lectures, you find this in, I think, the Ascent to Spiritual Illumination. Some of those books are really wonderful. Yeah. The Soul's Journey to Its Destiny. Yeah. Ascent to Spiritual Illumination. Mm-hmm. Meditation, Ecstasy and Illumination. These are all lectures of Swami Ashokanandaji, which were edited by Sister Gargi. So in one of these lectures, Swami Ashokanandaji says, the mind and the senses, they demand everything from us. You satisfy one desire, the mind and the senses crave for more. The mind and the senses take us for a ride, they pull us down, they drag us downward. You satisfy now, the mind will crave more. Then Ashokanandaji says, you know, in his own inimitable way. And you have this conversational tone of Ashokanandaji preserved in these books. Swami Ashokananda says, I can hear some of you say, that's not fair. But Ashokananda continues, the senses and mind don't care for fairness. So that's not fair will not help. That's what is the default condition. The senses and mind have a tendency to pull you down toward trash. So we need to resolutely cultivate awareness of the Atman. The more we cultivate that, the more we take our stand in that, the more we grow in self-mastery. That is why Swami Vivekananda was never tired of teaching this potential divinity in every one of us. That was his one central message. To teach and to man, to preach unto mankind their inherent divinity and to make it manifest in every moment of their life. That was Swami Vivekananda's sworn aim. And Swami Vivekananda gives his lectures, when we read his lectures, we are just swept off our feet by the lecture's inspirational quality.
Yes.
You just know, even a dead corpse will get up and then say, I can also live. That kind of a firepower you have in Swami Vivekananda's teachings. He says, and I think this from one of his lectures in Jnana Yoga. He says, mountain high, though the difficulties appear, gloomy and terrible, though all things seem, they are but Maya. Fear not, it is banished. Crush it, and it vanishes. Stamp upon it, and it dies. Be not afraid. Think not how many times you fail. Never mind. Time is infinite. Go forward. Assert yourself again and again. And light must come. So this resolutely cultivating awareness of the Atman, it's a full-time occupation. Our waking hours have to be spent in this. A very important teaching in Sanskrit is Asuptehi Amrutehi Kalam Naye Vedanta Chintaya. As long as you're awake, as long as you're alive, spend your time filling your mind with thoughts of Vedanta. Asuptehi until you go to sleep. Amrutehi until you die. Fill your mind with Vedantic thoughts. So we don't wait for the mind to think of good thoughts, but we consciously think of good thoughts. I read again the teaching from Swami Vivekananda, which we saw a few minutes back. The infinite future is before you, and you must always remember that each word, thought and deed lays up a store for you, samskaras, and that as the bad thoughts and bad works are ready to spring upon you like tigers, so also there is the inspiring hope that the good thoughts and good deeds are ready with the power of 100,000 angels to defend you always and forever. So we consciously think of good thoughts. We consciously think of thoughts that will free us. We consciously think that we are children of God, and with God's help we can surmount all obstacles, and God will do always what is right for me. So that makes my mind free from anxiety. Swami Ramakrishnanandaji, the founder of the Ramakrishna movement in South India, he gives this important teaching. Devotion to God and anxiety for anything cannot coexist. If you have devotion to God, you have dependence on God, and you leave things to God, and if you are worried about something, that means your devotion is not right. If you are devoted to God, you have the faith that God will protect me under all circumstances, and whatever happens to me is for my good. I may not get whatever I pray for, because my wants are infinite, but my needs may be limited. So God may not give us all the time whatever we pray for our own good. So devotion to God, dependence on God, and anxiety, worry, fear cannot coexist. Questions? Yes, please.
So this may be slightly tangential, but you said only the human being has the power to discriminate and attain moksha.
Yes.
So my question is, so what would have possibly happened in an animal life form that helped us evolve from there to a human being? And what So my question is, can we also go back, retrogress into the animal?
We can.
What would that event be in our human form? A pursuit of what?
Will make us go back to animal form.
Yes.
That is, if we don't exercise the human faculties that we have in the 16th chapter of the Gita, which is titled Divine and Demoniac Attributes, Asuri Sampat. If a human being just has only Asuri Sampat, that means he is body-born, Asuri, demons are body worshippers. Demons are usually portrayed with two horns and then the big teeth and all that. But that's only a figurative portrayal. It means being body-bound, considering matter to be the only reality, and completely dedicating their life for fulfillment of desire, and having no use for God or any higher things. If a person lives this life of unbridled sense enjoyment, he can be born as a subhuman being. I often think of this example. You have calculators, simple business calculator, plus, minus, multiplied by division, and maybe square root, and cancel. That's all, only so these few buttons. But you have also the scientific calculator. You have in your iPhone, you put it in portrait mode, you have the business calculator. Landscape, you have the scientific calculator. Now, scientific calculator has e raised to x, e raised to y, and log of x to any base, log of anything to base e, cos, sine, tan, cosine, cosecant, cot, and so on and so forth. And suppose you have a scientific calculator, and you use it only for plus, minus, into, divided by. God may choose to give you only a business calculator, and why should you be burdened with a scientific calculator? So a human being, he has been given this human being with some special faculties, exercise of the power of discrimination, which he doesn't do. God can think that he only deserves an animal body, because he's not going to make use of the special features of human body. So he goes to animal body. But in Hinduism, in Vedanta, no one is consigned, there is no eternal condemnation of anyone. That person once again can do a turnaround, and when the right time comes, he'll again become a human being. Because only in a human birth can moksha be possible. So yes, if a person fails to make use of his human life, he doesn't live as a human being, but mostly it's only manifestation of the animal nature in him, then probably he deserves only an animal body. And in an animal body, we need to keep in mind, there is no exercise of the will, volition. In animals, life is lived on the plane of instincts. Intuition doesn't come in animals. That means they don't exercise the will. And some desire arises in the mind, they just pursue it. Of course, you have pets which are loyal to the owner. All that happens by repeated habits. So they have some goodness in them, right? You don't nullify all that. But they cannot strive for their own spiritual evolution. They cannot think of anything higher in life. So that's about animals. If a human being continuously thinks bad, does bad, then there is every chance that he is born as an animal. But he can do a turnaround, and he can become a human being, and he also can aspire for self-realization.
So in the pursuit of moksha, if you are unable to attain that in this life, so it is fair to say that in the next life, if born as a human, we are better equipped to pursue this path again.
We are better equipped in that we have cultured our mind, and we couldn't attain perfection in this life. In the next birth, we have the same mind. We, the spirit, are associated with the same mind, but a new body. So, that brings us to an important point. It's never too late for spiritual life. We've heard that one of our senior Swamis, Swami Virishwaranandaji, who was our spiritual teacher, he initiated an old couple in their 70s. And after their initiation, they got to spend some time with him. They got an interview with him, spent some time with him. So they said they really felt sorry that they didn't know about all this, all these years. Their mind turned to this only now. They were blessed with initiation by him. So were their lives not a complete waste? So they were really sincerely thinking of these lines, but he assured them, you see, when you die, your body dies, but you are associated with the mind, which you can culture now. Use practice your spiritual disciplines now that you have received initiation. And as you practice spiritual disciplines, your mind grows in purity, grows in strength, and when you are reborn again, so you have a stronger mind, a purer mind. So we are culturing the mind. So it's never too late for spiritual life. So when we work on our mind, we continue from where we left off in this birth. We continue in our next birth.
So that leads to my personal question. So is it important to be formally initiated, even though one is in pursuit of a spiritual path?
If it becomes necessary, God Himself will arrange it.
But
otherwise,
it is not
in some cases, it is not necessary. So in some cases, their sheer longing for God will propel them forward. But in most cases, it is required. Initiation by a guru. Swami Brahmanandaji, this question was asked to him. He said, we don't ask this question whether a teacher is necessary when it comes to the pursuit of science, astronomy, astrology, or other things. We take it for granted. When you study chemistry or physics, you need a teacher. But when it comes to spiritual life, we have this question. The answer is, some people, by their sheer devotion, can get along without any teacher. And if a teacher is necessary, if we have that hankering, it will happen. And Brahmanandaji also says that even to be a pickpocket, you need a guru. So what to speak of this science, of all sciences, adhyatma vidya vidyanam. But it is fine. We can wait for that to happen, because God can be called, God can be directly called, prayed to. And if there is a need of a guru in our life, it will happen. Yeah. Yes, we can have a couple of more questions and then conclude. Yes, please.
Quick question. So we say that Atma is in bliss, Satchitananda Swarupa.
Once again, please.
The Atma is... Satchitananda Swarupa is
yes.
And why is it that the Atma has the inclination of falling down towards mind? Or is it that the Atma has the inclination? I mean, in other words, why is an individual I to follow the mind?
That is the default condition. Why should that happen? And when did that happen? We don't have that answer. Because the world is so kind of enticing. And when did we, the spirit, come to be associated with the mind? When did we start falling for objects of the world? Vedanta doesn't have an answer. Because it says, creation is eternal. There is no point at which creation began. There is no point at which I, the spirit, came to be associated with the mind, which was a clean slate. There is no point at which I started getting samskara, number one. It is without beginning. So when it came to be associated, Vedanta doesn't have an answer. It says it is beginningless, but it is not endless. We can put an end to this association of the Atman with the mind when we culture ourselves spiritually. Because this question is within the domain of Maya. Or let's say, this question is framed from within the domain of time, space, and causation. But the Atman transcends these three. Causation is associated with time. One event leading to another, that means a succession of events, means causality. And this can happen only in time. One event leading to another leads to the concept of present and future, or past and present. So causality and time are associated with, mutually associated. Then space. So this time, space, and causation, that is the domain of this world. That is what is called the domain of Maya, relative reality. So when we frame this question, why did the Atman choose to be associated with the mind? We are asking this question about the spirit which transcends time, space, and causation. How did the spirit come to be associated with this on the other side of the border? Time, space, and causality here, spirit here. How did this come to be associated with this? We are asking this question from here. We won't get an answer. we should get a locus from which we'll have a vision of this as well as this.
Mm-hmm.
Then we can get an answer.
Mm-hmm.
And that locus we are not in now. But once we transcend this and realize that we are the spirit, that we have transcended time, space and causation, this question is no more relevant to us. We don't care for the question anymore. We are worried about the question. We have this question when we are in the domain of Maya. So as long as this question is framed from within this domain, it is unanswerable. Because that is part of Maya. That is a characteristic of Maya. Maya is inexplicable. Maya, by definition, cannot be said to exist or not exist. So it doesn't have an answer within the domain of Maya. So it is, and one answer is it is beginningless. So we don't know when it came to be associated, why it came to be associated, the Atman came to be associated with the mind. But we know that this association can be broken. And that is what is spiritual practice about. And in Buddha's language, he would say, someone has hit an arrow and there is a wound in the body. Suppose we say, I am hit, I have wound in my body. And suppose I say, with what velocity the arrow came and hit me. Who hit the arrow? What is the arrow made of? Metal or some other thing? If we keep on thinking on these lines, my wound will start festering. Buddha says, focus on the wound. You know there is a wound. You know there is suffering. You know there is misery. Get rid of misery. And he says, leave all these metaphysical questions alone. But of course, in Buddha's case, he didn't talk about God, he didn't talk about the Atman. He talked about misery and how to get rid of misery. Something slightly akin to our question. So it is good to have questions, all right. And Vedanta tries to answer most of the questions. But questions should get answered from within ourselves. But these questions, when they are formulated from within the domain of time, space and causation, there is no answer. Vedanta says boldly that there is no answer. And when we transcend time, space and causation, the question doesn't exist for us. That is why we place our faith on the teachings of scriptures and of realized souls. That there is something beyond this time, space and causation, and that is my true nature. And I pin my faith, Shraddha, on this teaching and try to practice spiritual discipline.
Maharaj, a follow-up question in the lines of how you described the two states. If you are on the other state where you are not bound by time, space and causation, from that state, do you even acknowledge the existence of time, space, causation?
Yeah, by definition. You will acknowledge time, space and causation, but they won't be foremost in your consciousness. You will see them more as a shadow plane. It's like you're watching a movie projected on a screen. As long as we watch the movie, as long as during the duration of the movie, whatever happens in the movie is so real to us. We laugh with what happens in the movie, we cry with the movie, we are emotionally charged with what happens in the movie. But all the time it is the screen that is real. What is projected on the screen is not real. Right? Howsoever animated the movie may be. The screen alone is real. That we realize after the movie is over. But suppose you know from the beginning the screen alone is real. You see the movie still, but all the time you are conscious that whatever happens in the movie is unreal. The screen alone is real. So a jnani who has known the truth, he continues to live. He continues to live if that is what is required of him by God. Sri Ramakrishna says, most people abide in the state for a few days and then they give up their bodies. But he says some people, willed by God, will come back to their body consciousness and mental consciousness, and because they have some mission to be fulfilled. God wants them to fulfill some mission. So their body and mind are so pure that they serve as channels for the flow of divine wisdom. So they are aware of this multiplicity, but they are aware of the unity more. So they're able to see the whole thing as some kind of a shadow play. Sri Ramakrishna interacted with his disciples. He knew who was Narendra, who was Latu, and who was M. So he interacted with them as would do them good. But he was all the time, his mind was, he was all the time conscious of his unity with that spirit. He was also aware of multiplicity, which he called Bhavamukha. Bhavamukha is having apparently one foot in that consciousness, Brahman, and another in multiplicity. He is aware of both this and that. So he won't have any questions, any doubts, because that he is the spirit, is part of his nature. And he tries to teach others, trying to dispel their ignorance, and because he has a divine mission to fulfill. Yeah, but he won't be swayed by whatever happens in time, space and causation, because he knows all the time that it is a dream, that it is unreal.
If the, like for everybody, if the human beings' desire will not be fulfilled, and they will not, how they won't be angry, how they won't be delusion or memory loss. So for that reason, what they should do?
We pray to God, because the more we think about God, the less desires have their hold on us. The more we go toward the east, Sri Ramakrishna says, the more the west is left behind. The more we think of Rama, the less there is Kama. The more there is Kama, the less of Rama. Jahan Ram hai, wahan Kaam nahi. Jahan Kaam hai, wahan Ram nahi. So we try to fill our mind with Ram. That means we try to think of God more and more. We try to move more and more toward the east. So the west automatically recedes from us. So we desire the highest. We have a tendency to desire things. We desire the highest. Hari Maharaj, Swami Turiyananda, asked Sri Ramakrishna how to get rid of lust. Sri Ramakrishna says, why do you want to get rid of it, my boy? Increase it. This boy was surprised. As a spiritual seeker, he is struggling. He says, increase it. What is lust? The desire to get. Desire to get the highest. Desire to get God Himself and increase the desire. That's what Sri Ramakrishna said. So, we give a Godward turn to our impulses, to our desire. We make God the object of our emotion, than any human being, than our inanimate possessions. We laugh with people, we cry with people, we are happy with people, we are happy with coming close to some people, and when they leave us, we become miserable. So they are the locus of our emotions. They are the object of our emotions. But when we make God the object of our emotions, our mind grows in purity. Our mind grows in strength. So the answer is, we cultivate more and more love for God in our own humble way by repeating a divine name, by being steadfast in our spiritual practice. And desires, we get more and more detached from our desires. When we grow in mental strength, we are able to detach ourselves from our samskaras. And of course, as we saw before, our legitimate desires we fulfill keeping morality as in the background. That will help us grow in desirelessness. Yes?
We decided that as we need Guru for any physical science, we also need towards spirituality. So do we get to choose Guru, or does Guru happens to happen in our life?
You can say from a divine devotional point of view, the Guru comes to us when we pray for a Guru. Right? And we also have a choice in the matter. We get to observe our Guru. And if someone really appeals to you, you try to seek teaching from that Guru. And not the same Guru may not appeal to everyone. If someone appeals to you, you can seek. But the best would be to keep praying, to our Ishta Devata. And if you need a Guru, pray for him. And everything happens at the right time. At that time, when it has to happen, there will be no questions. There will be no questions in the mind. It will just happen. If it has to happen to you, it will happen. So the answer is, this is also true, that's also true. Your Guru is ordained by God, that is one. But you also get to choose. You should be comfortable with the person from whom you are going to take initiation. So you get to choose from that point of view. Right? So the best would be to do whatever spiritual practice we are doing and be prayerful to God. If you seek a guru, pray to God. It'll happen at the right time. It'll happen at the right time without any conflict, without any question. Yes.
Food is ready.
Very good. So we'll say for closing the prayer. Jananim Saradam Devi Ramakrishnam Jagadgurum Padapadme Tayo Shritva Pranamami Mohur Mohur Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Shri Ramakrishna Pranamastu.